I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Okay, so I think we'll start with the sort of basic question to set the stage, as it were. There's a short preface to this book, novel, play. You can go into that in a moment. Describing it as a dialogue that's constructed from conversations between friends, recorded over a few months. A film adaptation of the stage production also exists. This book version is its own thing, a literary object independent of the play, as well as a guide to staging it. So it seems to me that there's a number of levels of conception, process, editing, making, and that also this is in some ways an intermediate or shared object across platforms, genres, etc. So maybe you could say something about what it is.
Yeah. Go for it, Stephen.
All right. Thank you, Rick. I could say that from the very first, when we started working on this, we started working on it as a theater production. And we conceptualized it as a play, a film, and a book. So we always knew that it would have those three components. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but it also, I think also in you know, so originally it is the commission of a theater piece.
Yes.
Which was, you know, sort of from a theater asking for maybe an art angle on theatre, but we were very clear at the beginning that we wanted to engage with theatre proper, whatever that means, rather than sort of put contemporary art on the stage in some way. And immediately, both of us writing this thing with the kind of freedom that the invitation sort of afforded, really, which was that a lot of what we were writing would never be on stage, would not be sort of manifest, but would be part of this thing that then we could explore and expand into the book, and then also things that would only be apparent when we filmed it, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, like Steve says, it was a kind of simultaneous thing, but it was from an invitation that was very open. It was very like, would you like to do a piece of theatre for 6 weeks, you know, in a few years? And then the pandemic happened, and so we had a lot longer to work on it and to really establish our collaboration and to sort of work on what this thing would be as a vessel for the things that we were interested in, I suppose.
Yeah, and as Ed says also, our first decision was that it wouldn't be an installation on stage or anything like that. We wanted to take the medium and the history of theater very seriously. And then we also decided that the film has to also be a film.
Yes.
And the book has to be literature.
Yes.
Right? And so it was also this exercise of doing the same project in different mediums, but treating each medium, giving each medium its full dignity and trying our best to kind of like work within those parameters, while of course giving ourselves a lot of leeway as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and each of those forms kind of lose and gain.
Exactly.
At the same time, right? Yes. So there's loads of things that are in the book that, of course, appendices and also a lot of stage directions that neither happen nor are actable or anything. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there that is, but is part of the kind of this exported sensation throughout the whole thing. So it's exported to the media, each medium that is sort of used to hold this thing, but also to, I don't know, to sort of, one part will lose something and another thing will gain in that process.
Yeah, or they both lose.
Oh, they both lose, yeah. And there's a huge gap.
Yeah.
And neither of you had worked in theater proper before?
Never.
In terms of writing for the stage?
No.
So do you think that there's like some aspect of like circumventing? Do you see what I mean? It seems like you're talking about, we hear the word like hybrid a lot to discuss forms now. Mm. But what you've described is actually like an entity moving through different things in a separate iteration in each form rather than being fused together. And it strikes me that some of what what's in the book and some of which is in the film, which I've seen, but many people probably haven't, is like a kind of evasion of theatrical conventions.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if coming at it from these other angles, do you know what I mean, is a way of like unpicking or undoing those expectations.
I think maybe a good way to begin to answer that is because I'm sure many people here obviously haven't seen the play, which ran in Copenhagen, and you haven't probably seen the film. And you probably haven't read the book, which is coming out like today. So maybe the best thing is to just kind of describe what this thing is.
Nice. Just read the blurb.
So the play is, you know, again, we were trying to take theater seriously, not in an ironic way, but to just, if we're going to do theater, to just do it. So it is a chamber play. It takes place in one room. There are three characters who sit in one corner of that room and have a conversation for the first half of the play. They're three friends. They're just talking very warmly with each other. They're not talking about anything in particular. The conversation drifts from topic to topic. And all of the dialogue is derived from conversations between our small group of friends that we recorded over many months, and then we kind of, you know, worked through those transcriptions and edited it into a dialogue. Anyway, for the first 45 minutes or so of the play, you've just got three people hanging out in this one-room apartment, chatting. Halfway through, two of the friends go home for the evening, and then there's one person left in the apartment. And then they walk around the apartment and interact with some objects, some of which are magical. So you really have to think that the first half of it is like kind of a chamber play, but with no conflict, where people are just warmly conversing. And the second half of the play is a piece for solo dance, more or less. And the second half is silent. Although nothing is ever silent because there's like 40 mics hidden on the stage and in the floor, so everything is like squeaking and hissing the entire time. I hope that gives kind of a sense
of
what it is like.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm missing something.
No. That's good.
Yeah.
Well,
But that didn't answer your question. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah.
We can get back to maybe in a way when we talk about plot or narrative or the absence of these conventional things and the idea of the characters as well, whom we're not really invited to know particularly, right?
Yeah.
Or how we get to know them is through a kind of idiosyncratic dialogue, which I think would be familiar to many people reading it.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know,
conspicuously not as well. You know, many people who've come up after when they saw the play were like, "Is this how you speak to your friends, you know?"
Yeah.
Are you
okay? And or like, I don't have any friends like that, you know?
Yeah.
And friendship is a big part of it, but quite a sort of late stage friendship where there is no news. There's no, you know, it's quite sort of silly, really, and childish. Yeah. But also very, everyone knows each other to the nth degree, to a point where everyone's very, you know, like avoid things, and but also in certain testy moments that are very familiar or something. So the familiarity is sort of is a big part of the relationship here. But also this, exactly what Steve said, that there isn't really crisis within the relationships of the thing, you know, which is sort of unavoidable. You know, in the point where actors take it on, of course, it's unavoidable because they are people doing things. So there is this psychological inevitability to it, but at least on the page, there is this kind of, we're not doing that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there is, in the stage directions, and then on the stage, there is this kind of, exactly where does in the presumption that the crisis, that has to go somewhere, then it goes into, say, like Steve says, the sort of, the contact mics under the stage floor or the plumbed-in radiators around the edge, mm-hmm. all the things that are listed in the appendix of the book, which are these kind of very specific, peculiar insistences on slavish fidelity to something, you know? Mm. So there's that, definitely that, and so it sort of frees up the dialogue to be both real and sort of unimaginably flat or something, you know? Mm.
To just clarify something, something I'd said, the outline of the apartment on stage is not defined by walls, it's defined by plumbing and a couple of radiators, and that's how you know the limits of the apartment. And we insisted that the plumbing had to be plumbed into the theater and working, and that the radiators had to be on and hot, which was a kind of piece of unnecessary realism because the audience, of course, wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody, how would you know unless you went up and touched the stage?
Which
the
people
actors
did.
Yeah, a couple people did. Yeah. But the actors know it, and there's like a little bit of extra heat in the room, and then also, of course, the microphones mm-hmm. are picking up air and water moving through the plumbing. So it was also part of our kind of interest in kind of an excessive kind of realism or an excessive naturalism where you're working very hard to make something realistic that is actually almost imperceptible and it doesn't really matter.
But it's interesting how, you know, like when it's the book, it's like it's incredibly perceptible in as much as like it's pointed at as a kind of, if you're staging this, you must do this. You know, it's an insistence, really, whereas in effect, it's a kind of missable, oh, I didn't realize. Why did you do that? You know, that must have cost a lot of money or, you know.
What's the point?
It's an interesting, that's interesting in terms of the kind of the shift between media of what's apparent and what's not, and what's visible, or like, you know, chunks in this where entire stage directions are in the negative, so that what's not happening. And the list is quite, or like, you know, at the beginning it says that Peter's socks are the last socks on earth, which is a kind of, it's just thrown out there, but it's sort of playing to that point of kind of course, this is not available within the performed drama, but is available within the literature.
Yeah.
And then the film thing has its own, I mean, we're both big fans of kind of the awkward genre of filmed theatre.
Yeah.
No one likes it. You know, it's kind of, it's sort of bad.
It's missing something.
It's missing both sides, cinema and theatre.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a thing.
And when we made the film, we wanted to lean directly into
that. Oh, absolutely.
And directly, if you remember how film theatre, you know, you remember how film theatre was shown like 80s and 90s when I was a kid on like public television or something. And you get this camera that is like somewhere in the audience, and you can't really measure the distance with your eyes, but you can tell that there's a gap between the camera and the stage, and that gap kind of is part of how it loses its liveness or something like that. There's something missing there. And when we made the film, we really wanted to use that a lot, which maybe just circles back to what we've been talking about of kind of using the very, not just using the mediums, but using the various kinds of loss within each medium. Or something like that.
I mean, it strikes me that some of what you're describing as well fits much more in like cinematic tropes than it does in theater. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, the actors often in your play they have very minute facial expressions or they do small things. It's not, I mean, there are some big gestures, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's more for camera close-up than for stage acting, which is often much bigger, you know. So you get like when you get film actors on stage, it's really hard for them to figure out how to express. Or this idea of somehow creating a space that's actually like holding heat, like a room would.
Yeah.
Or having the space filled with sound that also becomes a material or a character or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me that there's something that you're doing on the stage with time and space that's much more attributable to film. I don't know. Do you think that's, or that you're pulling on?
I mean, hopefully there's a kind of a seesawing thing of loss and gain, and that the loss in one medium is felt as a gain in another. But a lot of that is just felt rather than a kind of perceptible. Like if you're watching the film, you're not aware of the heat, of course. Mm. Although arguably you're not aware of the heat in the audience in the theatre anyway. but you're still, I mean, it's evident in the literature, but I think also there's a commitment in there in the concept of a kind of where do we place realism in this thing? Mm. There's a sort of constant thread And, you know, in the beginning, there's part of this kind of exporting of crisis and also just recording conversations between friends and then transcribing and, of course, editing it, but really not adding, except tiny segue moments, you know, was a kind of, you know, there's a peculiarity in insistent realism at certain points in any kind of art form, I think. And it feels queasy sometimes that. And quite exciting to sort of here's an opportunity for a kind of for a level of realism that is not even perceptible but is there and is felt. So the actors, of course, are a bit too hot on stage, which of course they always are. But you know, but they're also they've got their little Madonna mics on and they're doing it. It's interesting how technology can sort of both sort of disappear but also make excessive kind of moments of reality.
And I think those, so they're wearing microphones so that they don't have to project, which I think ties into your question, right? Which is, I mean, they're all stage actors, so they wanted to project, and then they couldn't, and we asked them, of course, not to. And so they're talking, it's true that they're kind of acting and talking in a way that's more familiar from film or television, but I think that the technology that allowed them to do that is just simply the fact that they're wearing this microphone, and then their voices are, you know, We raise the level of their voices pretty high. You know, it's like at the limit of where it would be feeding back, right? Yeah. So they really had to speak softly, and they had to keep everything understated. They were constrained by the mics in that way.
I wanted to ask about the role of like gesture and habits, which the characters speak about quite a lot. So it opens with them talking about how they put their jumpers on, right? And this is what I meant when I, when you know, that you can like imagine yourself. I was reading it thinking, wait a minute, how do I put my jumper on? You know, it's like one arm, two arms, over top, whatever. So it opens with this idea of like the embodied self in a way, and things that like one notices or doesn't notice. And then this recurs throughout in the stage directions in terms of talking about how the characters might be running their hand over the sofa in a kind of tender way, as if it's a geography. And this comes back again later when it's describing what another character is doing. So there seems something interesting to me about this use of gesture to make characters. But also I was wondering what you were thinking in terms of creating this terrain of behavior.
I mean, I think a thing to introduce would be like a notion of dance in relation to... Also like that felt... this is maybe just me, I don't know, but I don't think so. But a space for artifice that was less problematic than acting in some way, that something about the attention being drawn to a gesture, I don't know, you know, it's familiar from maybe a Pina Bausch, but less hysterical in that kind of... which is something you can do with the camera, of course, but we're trying, at least in the second half particularly, to really, like... point to things that, like when he's picking up all the bottles by sticking his fingers in each of the things, which is a very, everyone does that, but there's a kind of audience performer internalized thing there, you know. Yeah, that's not answering your question either, but what are gestures doing in that, Stephen?
Or there's like, you know, she puts her hair.
Yeah, that's lots of improv.
Or doing kind of strange hand motions to end.
Yeah, that's really good.
It's really good.
Do you want me to do more?
Whatever you just mentioned, part of the play, I'll be like, yeah, that's a good part.
I think there's something that affords that the I'm just trying this out, but like that affords the elevated gestural space because of the. You know, banality of what they're talking about, or the kind of the lack of crisis and drive and sort of plot to things. That there is this kind of loosed attention that's able to both in the actor but also in the script and things to attend to minutiae.
And also, I think, I mean, I'm very interested. I think Ed is as well. Like in
careful,
yeah, in habit. And repetition, but also in specifically in kind of the self-sensuality of habit, in the pleasure of habit, right? And in the pleasure, like all these, you know, in the opening conversation, people were talking about how they take put their clothes on and off, not in a specifically erotic way, but just literally how you put a jumper on, how you take a jumper off. But at the same time, there's a kind of bodily pleasure and a kind of repetition in that you make those moves because you personally like to make that particular gesture to put your jumper on. And mm-hmm. and then the like for me, to maybe put it a little bit too strongly, but I think it's true, is like it's also thinking about like what kind of self-sensuality or what kind of masturbation exists like in putting on a jumper, mm-hmm. right? And kind of diffusing the erotic and diffusing the self-sensual erotic mm-hmm. into kind of habit. Mm-hmm. And just minute gesture that are just part of our daily life, but are still also a person touching themselves mm-hmm. in a way. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's also interesting moments of kind of like estrangement from the self. So there's this passage about one of the characters' father once cracked eggs into a pan and they were black because they were rancid. And then there's this question that one of the characters says is, you know, how do we know what the smell of rotten eggs is? And they're all trying to think how they know what it is or what it smells like. And there's another one where, you know, they play a game which is like, pretend you've never had a headache before. Mm-hmm. Describe it to me. Mm-hmm. So there's this funny sort of scripted movement. But at the same time, one of the things that's happening in that group is a kind of unsettled understanding of physical experience or of corporeality, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, it's fascinating. Just the way you described that is thinking about the scripting in just having conversations with friends. Because, of course, those are subjects, those are things that we talked about just because we're hanging out, you know, day after day. Essentially a kind of bubble during the one of the lockdowns in Copenhagen. Yeah, I mean, it is peculiar. I mean, you know, the feeling of those questions or the kind of prompts that would be, that are so explicitly scripted, which are also they translate into sort of games, really, the gamification of conversation, which kind of maybe emerges out of the bottom of a certain kind of boredom as well.
A very low-stakes game.
Very low-stakes game.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that scripting is, of course, unavoidable in that situation, of course, becomes sort of sings when one actually transcribes it and turns it into script. Mm-hmm. But what was the question again? Sorry.
You know what? I don't.
No, it's fine. I'm sorry.
Something about estrangement.
No, it's a really nice
unsettling. Yeah. But
I think it's also, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about this play is about friendship. It's three friends are talking throughout most of it, and just being friends together, and you're just watching them be together. But as Ed said, it's a late stage friendship, and I think one of the interesting things is that we were both thinking about and talking about as we were making this is. What happens in friendships where you see somebody, you see people so much and you know each other so well that you don't kind of engage in the familiar social performances that you're used to, and you just kind of, I mean, there's something kind of paradoxical where very intimate friendships become a little bit automatic, mm-hmm. almost. You're not really trying to impress each other. You don't have news for each other all of the time. You're not necessarily like, of course, there are people you could have heart-to-hearts with, but you're not having heart-to-hearts with them every day. A lot of conversation is just blank in a way. It's literally keeping the friendship alive by just continuing to talk, right? And that is a kind of game, and it becomes this kind of, you're a couple of automatons talking and playing games with each other. And that is like, in some ways, like one of the highest forms of intimacy, right? And so it's simultaneously... Yeah, it's simultaneously a closeness, but there is an estrangement in that too, where you move away from the kind of signals of intimacy that we're used to, which is that you open your heart to each other all the time.
But of
course, with your very close friends, you actually don't. You're like, you know, you're just texting bullshit to each other, or you're just chatting about literally nothing.
Blue tits.
What?
Blue tits.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There is a weird point that seemed quite serious to me, though, where one of the characters is speaking about having surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you know that's what I was going to say?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's the only bit.
Yeah, it's the only bit, yeah.
And said, you know, I was, like, really upset about going under general anesthetic because I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
And then says, you know, it's actually, like, 1 in 30,000 people who dies. And then Peter, the male character, is like, and I bet it would be you.
Yeah.
And says it twice. And I couldn't actually figure out what it was, like this strange moment, and she just sort of looks at him, and then the conversation carries on in a different direction.
But that's also true. Someone tried that joke.
Right.
I think like someone's like, there's like a shift in the tone. Someone is reporting on something genuinely difficult that happened in their life. And then someone is misreading the entire, like anyone might, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know, like it's real, I suppose.
It was one of you guys.
It probably was me.
It was definitely Ed, yeah.
Do you think so?
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's fine.
What happens in this room stays in this room.
It's on a podcast, I think.
But it's also weird, you know, like all the people, because it's not just three people that we recorded either.
No, it's much more, yeah.
Right.
So they all came to see it and they all know that they said those things.
Yeah. But it's just a joke.
It's a document as well, though. You know, like it is important. Yeah. It was important, or it became important, or it became less important, that it was a sort of documentary of some peculiar stripe, you know.
Mm-hmm. But then to, you know, to kind of follow up on the thought just before this one, I think it still has something to do with this intense level of blank friendship where somebody can open up and talk about their surgery and somebody can make a joke that doesn't land that in another context might be kind of hurtful. But in there is a certain kind of trust and familiarity that's already been established so that neither of those things really reach high pitches
in a certain way.
Yeah. They are both like accepted and they're both just part of the circulation of that friendship.
Yeah. Right. Everyone in that group is very aware of how to ameliorate and soften certain bits at, you know, peaks that might be coming or not, and sort of, you know, perform the dance together.
Mm. Which is also maybe why the actors are told to act so low.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Like quietly and naturalistically to bring out, and like stiffly also, right? Mm-hmm. To bring out that bit of roboticness.
Mm. I mean, on the other end of things, there's a second part of the play.
Yes.
And I wonder if now's a good moment for you guys to read from that section where the play becomes silent, but there's effulgence of description and drama.
Yeah, what should we read? The head?
The head.
So should I just say?
Yeah, please do. Please do.
This is another serious moment.
Yeah. There's some technological gadgets involved in the play.
I could read that appendix. The mirror, the mirror, screen mirror.
Yeah, you explain what it is.
I mean, it tells you.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah, do it.
A screen mirror thing is at the center of the back of the stage. It's about 2 meters square. In front of the screen mirror is a low table counter thing, the same length as the mirror and at the height of a desk. It's quite deep. Why? Well, it's deep enough to allow for a rectangular hole to be cut out of it to fit a projector that is suspended in a wooden box beneath the table counter thing. Because the projector is so close to the screen mirror, the projector has an ultra-short throw periscopic lens on it. Beneath the screen mirror is a camera on a tripod with a lens with a very low aperture and a strong zoom so that when something comes close to it, it's very clear. It's very clear. And when things are more distant, they are abstract and blobby. This camera is angled up at the face of whoever, Peter, sits at the table counter thing. The camera feeds the projector this image. The projector projects this image onto the screen mirror. For most of the play, the audience cannot see anything in particular on the screen mirror. It's kind of like a splotchy grey light. When the actors pass by on their way, they suddenly and briefly show up on the screen mirror. When Peter sits down to unpack his face, two lights by the camera shine up to light up his face. At the same exact time, the stage lights dim, except for the lights on the Peter area. When Peter's there, all the focus is on the screen mirror, except that the TV is still on all the time. So there are actually two screens on stage to look at. That didn't need reading out, I don't think. But there's a big thing.
So there's a big screen at the back of the stage.
Yeah.
And when he puts his face close to it, his face shows up on the screen.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
It's described as like a shaving mirror, which has the little
close-up. The magnifying thing.
Yeah. And then,
sorry.
No, it's good.
Oh,
and then, and then at the very end, he does a mime routine in the...
He pulls apart his face.
Yeah, he pulls apart his face. Mime's pulling apart his face. And we'll read the instructions that we gave to Peter to do that.
Just
no, you can start.
Okay.
And also does sound script? Effects with his mouth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much.
True. Yeah.
Auto Foley.
Yeah.
Peter sits before the mirror and looks. The lights in the room dim and the lights in the table brighten. The projection of Peter's face is vivid. He looks at himself without examining himself. Not like he's checking out a mole or scrutinizing a new wrinkle, just looking at his face. He moves his head a bit, Maybe he fishes the last bit of spaghetti out of his teeth with his tongue. This is all a pause. After the pause, with one hand, Peter reaches up and matter-of-factly pretends to unscrew and remove an eye, making convincing squishy noises with his mouth. The eye pops out and he makes a little popping sound with his mouth, and he pretends to look at the removed eye with his other eye.
Peter takes the unscrewed eye and pretends to put it on the table top, all the way to the left. Then he continues to mime unpacking his face, removing his features one by one and placing them on the table. He doesn't necessarily do all of the following actions, and not necessarily in this order, maybe half. He proceeds with a straightforwardness, like he has done this before, pretending to remove the features of his face. He places each feature on the table in a line that extends from left to right. He pauses between each action as if to let his face reset. The whole routine takes about 10 minutes. So there's about, I don't know, 25 or so actions in here, but he did 12, 15?
Yeah.
Something like that. Not all of these. I'll just read some of the actions. Pop eye out. With one hand, stretch lids, with the other take the eye out, like taking out a contact lens, but the whole eye. Slight shiver. The body doesn't necessarily want to do it. Like when you're trying to make yourself sick, there's some resistance in the body. Hold it preciously, like if you were taking apart a watch or a clock. Don't lose the little bits. It comes away with a little gunk. Catch that gunk as well. Maybe a string follows the eye. Be careful with it. Look at it. Check that it's all there. Teeth. Just a few at a time, using fingers like pliers, and then maybe take out the whole bottom layer at once, like dentures. Teeth are quite hard, so you need to use both hands. Some are more stubborn than others. Strain against them, and then they give, come out in a rush. Tonguing of the gum where the tooth was. It's bloody. Peeling off lips. Like getting your fingernail under tape. Hard to catch the edge. Slow. Be careful not to snap it, break it. Both lips in one motion. Nose. Quick snap and then pull off with a catching motion. Hold it delicately in two hands as it's placed on the table.
Ears. Peel them down. They come right off. Cheek. Puff it up. Get the skin at the base of the jaw, as if there's a zip. Finding it is a bit hard. Once you've got the zip, hold the cheek so it doesn't drop on the floor, but unzip with relief. Relaxing of the face, only one cheek. Find central zipper in hair. Rooting around in hair on the back of the head, find it, unzip it to chin or bottom of neck. Pull apart from the forehead. When it's unzipped, it's baggy. Then it's kind of on your shoulders. Brush it back like a hood. This one doesn't go on the table, you just wear it like a hood. Eyes again, hand in front, ready to catch the eye, thwack at the back of the head, the eye falls into the hand, one and then the other. Jaw, move it back and forth to loosen it a bit, side to side, then pull it out of its socket, not too much resistance, like pulling the limb of a plastic figurine and it pops out of the ball joint. Tongue, some pulling with both hands, with fingers on the sides of the tip, and then a gentle yank. Comes out pretty easily. Hold it very delicately. Tongues are quite long, longer than you would think. You have to drape it down slightly. Fistful of hair, kind of like pulling hair out of a hairbrush, getting a clump and pulling it at once.
Just read a few more. Throat. Small door on neck. Little handle that you turn, or a catch. Open the door as if it's a closet. It swings open. One hand has to hold the door open, it's a little heavy, while the other hand gets in there. Remove something from the neck with a few fingers, like you're taking a doll's dress on a hanger off a rack in a dollhouse. Then close the door. You don't want to leave that open. Air around the eyes. The area that would be under goggles. Basically looks like you were taking off goggles, but there's no band holding them on. Not actually goggles. Like air that is somehow suctioned to the face. Bridge of nose. Pulling it out. Don't resist at all. Like it's just sitting there on top of the nose, balanced there. Air around the cheeks. There's no description for that one. Find something, little bits, between lips and gums. Way up in there. Unscrew it. Or unplug it. Like finding a tiny screw when you don't have the right tool and you try to do it with your fingers. Touch roof of mouth just before the gagging point. So there's a little bit of hesitation because you don't want to gag. As if pressing a button, like a reset button that's on the back of a machine, in a place where it's not easy for it to be accidentally pressed. You have to press quite hard. But it doesn't do anything that we can see. Pull finger out slowly.
Great. I liked how, Ed, you were starting to do
But I was, yeah.
Loosen the jaw.
Yeah, make it quarter.
But also, it's, you know, like this thing comes from things one might do in front of a mirror on one's own. Just trying out that. Because you don't need to be... I mean, one doesn't need to be convincing alone, you know, to anyone. Mm. But given a mirror or given some sort of way to look at oneself, mm-hmm. one might end up in sort of these places, I think.
I mean, the body and the breaking body, the malfunctioning body, the dysfunctional body, the unsettling body that has bugs under the skin. One of the characters has a dream that there's bugs under her skin or worms and wakes up and finds that she has a real tick on her hip that she plucks out, and the other character keeps asking if she got the face out, which struck me as very funny because you want the head. You don't picture a tick's face. Right. And there's a lot of like really noisy eating, sucking of grapes into the microphone, kind of slobbering of spaghetti, which is described as being put into his body, into Peter's body. So there's this funny thing of the body having holes in it, but also being capacious and coming apart, and an aspect of violence. Someone talks about a friend who has a fantasy of smashing a brick into their collarbone.
Yeah.
So there, you know, there's these unsettling moments of, you know, the body being punctured by an awareness of itself for whatever reason. Maybe you could say something about that and how the conversation between the friends relates or maybe doesn't to this unpacking of the face.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if there's another kind of body than the one that it's like falling apart in various ways or being taken apart or being played with or dissembled or and so on. And I also think that in both Ed and Isleworth, respectively, bodies are always thought very flexibly. In that sense, sometimes there's a bit of violence to it, sometimes there's not, but there's certainly kind of a conception of the body as a machine or an object that is malleable and can be reassembled or taken apart, I think, in different ways.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, I mean, this is what's peculiar about this in a way, is like talking about conversations that other people, you know, there are obviously parts of conversations that are scripted and directed and stuff, but you know, the kind of the textures of maybe it's a sort of limit of news to a certain extent is to speak of the body in a kind of imminent way of like, well, to speak to my mother would be to speak of her coccyx forever or something, you know, be like some sort of bot. That's a terrible, I hope she never hears it. But I mean, like a, you know,
it's
like,
a podcast.
I mean, it's like a sort of this is news as well as me, my body, and I.
Yeah.
So there's that, the reporting of the body in that way. But also, I think there is, you know, the whole second half is a kind of self pleasuring thing. Some of Peter's gestures are from watching my daughter, who's six, you know, doing things with herself, which are what you would try to do. You would test a body in that way and find something that fit and felt terrific or weird or whatever. But it's a constant exploration, even into the kind of the sort of quote-unquote tedium of just talking about, something happened to me, or a fantasy I had, which is sort of, again, maybe it's a fantasy that is not a sort of top shelf, top level fantasy, but it's kind of quite low down in the list of fantasies that you report upon or that you remember that you have or something like the compression fantasy or the brick on the collarbone thing. There's a kind of, you know, rediscovering a relationship maybe through a kind of automatic touch or something. There is a kind of, those things maybe, yeah.
Before we move on to questions, maybe I'll ask one or two more. Just,
sure.
I wanted to ask about like the writerly aspects of particularly there's an italicized voice that comes in page 54, which is, you know, roughly a third of the way through. And, you know, to distinguish for people, basically there's the dialogue, there's stage directions, and then all of a sudden there's an italicized voice that starts to say more unusual things. To describe urges that characters have, which we don't really know anything about previously. Mm-hmm. So it's like she has to do it, like something happened to her eyes and she has to get them out.
Yeah.
Or later, there's this passage about this idea of stiffening, which is describing a movement that Peter's doing, but it's in this different font than the other movements. And then there's this other passage where Peter leaves and the room is silent. But then this italicized voice starts to describe the objects in the room taking on life.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say something about these tonal shifts or the description, or you know, what is this italicized voice? I'm curious also in a writerly way about how that was composed, because it's obviously quite different than the dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was all composed orally.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no division in labor, a division of labor in the writing, and we kind of wrote it all out loud together. We would talk through sentences and write down the sentences.
Yeah.
So I think that's why it both sounds a little bit like voice and a little bit broken. And it's obviously written. It is writing. It's meant to be writing, but it comes out of this other place. It's not like composing a sentence on a blank Word doc. So I think that's one part of it.
I think it is also conspicuous writing, in as much as it's not, or rather it has its own sake, you know, rather than the other things that have direction and have things. I mean, you know, we had to have two different scripts for the actors. We had this sort of burgeoning novelized or sort of expanded thing. And then that was obviously crazy for an actor to encounter, because there's loads of things it's telling you not to do.
Mm. And things that don't happen in the play.
And things that don't happen.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of phantom space. So we had another script that was just the practical, you know, like, what do they actually need to do this? You know, they had access to the other one as well, just in case that was of interest, I suppose. But maybe that speaks to a sort of negatively practical writerliness or something, you know, that it's not... Mm. It's not, it was these sort of glorious spaces where we could talk and really, you know, like voice this kind of feeling around what was happening or what might be being felt by the actors and what, you know, I don't know. It's a sort of an extra tracing of a sort of space around the things. But yeah, I think the voice, particularly that kind of italicized interjection or something, is because it's very much born of us talking and immediately writing it down, like, what does that feel like, exploring a sort of bad metaphor or something, you know?
And also it was, you know, a very intentional inclusion of inconsistency, right?
Yes.
We wanted the book to be very inconsistent.
Yes.
And so there are these italicized sections which, you know, they don't quite sound like the other sections, but they don't sound that different either. So sometimes it's hard to know why they're italicized, but they do interrupt the book nonetheless. And I think that across all three versions of Sorcerer, in the play, in the film, and in the book, I think we are working with how to use the medium to introduce inconsistency, or if inconsistency is a bad word, then like a simultaneous variety of fidelities or something like that. Right? Some of it is very, very hi-fi and crystal clear, and at the same time, other elements are kind of junky and opaque. And I think that's something that is in all three in different ways. In the book, it takes the form of these interruptions of the dialogue or interruptions of the prose that feel more like notes, or they feel a little bit more unfinished.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, I think we should open out to questions. I have more if there aren't any, but there's a lot of nice looking folks here. Does anyone have a question?
One of you at the start, I think it was Ed, said something about a gap. You said the word gap. And I suppose I'm just wondering, this idea of like a play without conflict, I've sort of seen some experiments of over the years. It seems incredibly risky thing to do. It's almost like you're up against the campfire, the evolutionary sort of history of narrative. And I was wondering if there was any gap between what you had sort of planned to do and how you actually, that actually played out. Was there any kind of gap there?
I mean, definitely that, you know, because neither of us had written and directed theatre before, the shock and the amazement at the actor's arrival, you know, suddenly there's people who arrive and they've memorised the whole thing and they go straight into it and they change everything, and not everything, right, you know, but there's this extraordinary, terrifying moment of kind of people saying all of this stuff again, which is peculiar because we've already heard our friends say all of these things. So there was a gigantic gap. And then there's the other, just sticking with gap, but there's also this huge moment when the audience arrives and they change everything as well, because they arrive, everyone arrives with presumptions of how to resolve things. You know, the discomfort or not of not knowing about something, or of feeling like, but what that's their motivation or something, you know. And at various points, an actor or other might be sort of a bit miffed about why is this happening? Where's this going? What's going to happen? You know, and I think the audience every night, which was kind of extraordinary, people would resolve it as a unit, the audience, in very different ways. If one confident person started laughing early on, it was a comedy. The whole thing was insane and uproarious. And then if they didn't, then there'd be this kind of desperate silence of what is this thing? And then it could maybe sit in some other space. But I mean, the kind of a play without crisis is not the banner headline thing. It wasn't, it was more, that was part of the fidelity to the transcribed dialogues, you know. Not that those don't exist, but that they are not part of what's unfurling here in between these people, you know. It's not a situation, because speaking of realism as something that one might presume to be generally sort of negative in some way, like people believe things or feel that things are real if they're slightly more miserable in some way. And we didn't want to do that. I think we wanted to sort of trace a kind of realism that was us, like most of life is not that, is something else. And even if that's sort of quote unquote less interesting or something, there was a kind of attempt to maintain that throughout. And part of that was the direction of the actors to sort of quell their importing of drama and like looking to the rafters and sort of bringing thespian something to it to kind of elevate everything and, like, you know, bring it down. So there was a fidelity to that. But there were loads of gaps. I'm not answering your question, but you know.
Ed, I just wanted to think back to some of your older films where you were using a sort of digital avatar. And I think you said at one point for the purposes of not having to film a real person, and that allowed you to sort of, in a way, do the kind of formal artistic things on this avatar that you might have ethical concerns, sort of treating a real person's image that way. And I'm interested in that sort of that ethical concern about treating someone's image versus the way in more recent work in this play that you might verbatim be transcribing conversations with friends. And is there, like, qualitatively, what's the difference in sort of the two materials, like someone's image and the conversation that would transpire between two family members or two friends? Yeah,
I mean, a big thing is collaborating. And obviously sort of more monolithic, insoluble things for me are happily sort of not there necessarily. Also, it's not, you know, part of that quandary for me was answered through computer generated stuff rather than actually having to film people. It's a very different thing, I suppose. I mean, there's various sort of layers of artifice which afford certain kind of areas of remove, maybe, from a person doing something. I mean, I find it hard to, because with CG, one can, you know, of course, do anything at all, and it's just, it has a plasticity that's sort of infinite in some way. Whereas a person, you know, Peter at the end, say, as the sort of most violent aspect of this thing is someone miming, taking their face apart in the mirror. But it's not, there's no part of it that is horrible. I mean, there is, in as much as it's sort of nodding towards visceral violence in some way, but it's clearly pleasurable. I mean, clearly no one is making him do this, although the script is, of course, doing that. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't really have I haven't thought about it like that, to be honest. Sorry. Yeah. Do you have some ethical things to say?
Oh, no.
No? I'm sorry.
I wanted to ask about the title. How did you come up with that? Where did that come from?
Steve, why did we call it?
Well, we would like to leave that very open, I think. Not to give a coy answer. I'm not trying to be arch or anything like that. But I think that when asked that question, we just try to say that we like the way that that title casts a certain light on the work. And hopefully we'll create a certain feeling, or maybe the audience will ask certain questions about that title. But I don't think that they're really answerable by the work. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, now that you've written a play, how would you feel if someone else adapts it and directs it?
That'd be really good. How would if someone else mounted the play?
Oh, yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah, yeah.
I just wondered if you could say a bit more about that, like in terms of the different forms and like, oh, sorry, how you would, you know, like you'd have even less control, I guess, about gaps and...
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe they could make you watch them adapt it. That would be really mean. I don't know.
I mean, there was, you know, a big thing was doing it in English in Denmark. It's not that often that there are plays mounted that are in English.
In fact, the theatre had never done one before.
Yeah. Mm. And also all the actors, it's their second language, or third, yeah, or fourth.
Yeah.
And so that was particularly difficult for them, but also depends what you like. But I, you know, that kind of, those kinds of removal from some sort of nativeness add another something. I mean, this is obviously not in the book, but is in the film and on the stage, although also not on the stage, because there's a Danish audience going to see this play in Copenhagen in English. So that, again, it's another kind of peculiar, contextually specific sort of thing. But it would be amazing, you know, like the fantasies of people from different places putting this thing on, feeling the kind of what vernacular does to intimacy or presumption and all of, you know, lots. Yeah.
I was wondering about this work, you know, called Sorcerer, that has three different works within it, and whether they were all occurring, coming into being at the same kind of time, or thinking about how the different ways in which people would access them. So the book Travelling has a sort of democratic element to it, and that it can go and meet people, and the stage can only, you know, I can't go and see that. And whether, yeah, these are three strands that you would like people to kind of know as one work that is Sorcerer, or are they totally kind of separate entities?
I mean, I hope that they all have their own autonomy, because probably the majority of people will only encounter one version of them. And of course, it would be too much to expect an audience to somehow encounter all three versions, or, you know, an unrealistic. I mean, of course, if you get a chance to see the film or something like that, then that's fantastic. And hopefully that would add something to your reading of the book. But I think that we want each thing to stand alone. Mm. Each thing is its own object, and it is separate from the other objects. Of course, the play is just done, right? I mean, at least this version of the play, the one that we filmed. We're never going to stage it again in that space with those actors, because that's not how theater works. So that is inaccessible to everybody, including ourselves. But I think it's nice to encounter the film or to read the book and to also to imagine that there are other versions of this thing that are integral, inextricable part of it, but that you don't have access to. And that is another kind of loss that we're playing with here. It's another kind of like missing piece that becomes part of the work in some way. You know, not as a game, not as a game against the viewer or something, but as a component of it.
I was just wondering more about the experience of writing together, because I know you spoke about writing the italicized person that comes in, but also writing these three characters together. What was the rhythm of that, like sort of juggling three people between two people? How does the conversation between you two come in as well, between these three characters?
Yeah, oh Steve
I think it was a pleasure. It was one of the great pleasures of my writing life. In fact, it was really fun. I think the whole thing is premised on our ability to collaborate in some
way. Which is very rare, I think.
But to describe that process is a little bit tricky. I mean, also because it was a very protracted process. I mean, as Ed said, because of the pandemic, we had like 2 years to develop this play. So it happened over quite a long time. And then, of course, there was the time of editing the film, and there was the time of editing and preparing the manuscript. So it's really difficult for me to kind of have a sense of what that collaboration was, because it just, it's...
But it was definitely like, it was the highlight of the week, was the day that, you know, we'd sort of hang out and talk about these things. But it's also, you know, it's worth saying centrally to this thing in lots of ways is friendship, you know, both in the play itself, but also in the creation of the thing. So there is a kind of sense that... it's it suffuses the whole piece, I think, and but also that a lot of the things that we did in this that we do in this thing are things we wanted to see based on a lot of very close shared interests in very specific weird things, you know, or like what we want to hear, what kind of music are we into, or what kind of cinema, you know, so a lot of it is kind of meeting at that point of kind of mutual desire and admiring one another's work and stuff, and so and then an opportunity, really a kind of very lucky thing of someone inviting this to take form and then really running with it and being like, let's just keep going really if we can, you know. So
and I think that a shared I mean, maybe the really rare thing is a shared sense of intuition or ability to kind of find an intuition together.
Yes.
So I think one of the things that was interesting to me about this collaborative process is that in a funny way, we didn't talk through a lot of decisions. We never stopped and explained or justified why we wanted to do something. You know, somebody would have an idea and the other person would go, eh, or, oh, that's interesting. And we would move from there. But we share a lot of common ground in terms of our interests and our tastes. But also, I think that there was, beyond that common ground, which is just, you know, common cultural consumption, there was also an ability to just go there with each other and trust each other's intuition, and also shoot it down when necessary, of course, because, you know, of course, you have 20 bad ideas before one good one. But again, it wasn't this kind of justificatory thing. We didn't say, I want to do this because it's really interesting because of these X, Y reasons. It was just like, what if he pulls his face apart? Like, oh, okay.
Just following up from that question, was there any conflict? Did you guys fight while writing, filming, putting up the play?
Is that a conflict?
No. Not really.
No.
There was conflict with other people in the production of various bits.
That's different.
That's different.
Yeah, let's not go there.
No, sir.
But no, but there were moments of disagreement, of course.
Yeah.
Like, there was moments where one of us was, you know, stuck on an idea, and then the other one. And there was there was one big part of it that I wanted to take out, actually. Like, I really, really thought it wasn't working, and I was frustrated with it, and Ed insisted that we keep it in. And now it's my favorite part of it. So Ed was right. But again, I don't think that that was...
It's not conflict. That's part of a similar intuition, I think.
Yeah, that was like a panic attack. Yeah. More than like a conflict.
Yeah.
I might just ask like one last.
Oh, please.
Because I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't mention that at one point a printer cartridge levitates off the table and just stays there.
There's a
bed in front of the stage.
Oh, yeah.
Whose covers are moving the whole time. I was thinking about this idea of the word sorcerer not meaning anything, but having a kind of patina or a halo. Do you know what I mean? That these things hang off of words or spaces or movements or objects, and that there's something interesting about the ambiguity of what they're doing because they're doing something else. And I wonder, if you'd like to say.
I think it's a lot of things. You know, I think one of the things was making some theatre. Mm. It was a kind of using the stage, using tropes, using tech that... Or playing to the suspensions of disbelief that are convention within theatre. Oh, yeah, we don't see the wire or whatever. You know, there's a bit of that, but also a kind of really desire between this kind of mundanity or banality or something and this sort of miraculous.
Yeah.
But then the miraculous and the banal, neither are seen necessarily or witnessed as such, you know, as kind of pointed at to be those things in some way. They're both sort of subsumed within... the experience. I mean, there's also, I think the levitation printer cartridge does sort of introduce a shift in something. You know, there is a kind of aloneness to witnessing that. And the fact that he doesn't remark upon it.
Mm. Yeah.
That kind of signifies a kind of, oh, okay, you know, like we're not in his head, but we're sort of not quite here anymore. Or we're with him or something, you know. But there was definitely a design. I mean, the best day, maybe one of our mutually best days of working existence was to this day in the theatre where they hired a magician consultant to come in and talk about levitation.
Yeah, to teach us how to levitate something.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And he didn't actually give us the answer we needed, but he gave us a great history of like things, and it was like maybe electromagnets. You know, maybe like this. We were like this huge, in the table we'll embed these electromagnets. It was a strange thing. It was really great, you know, but also a pinch yourself kind of, what are we doing? You know,
it was great. Yeah, it was fantastic.
But we're really insistent that this printer cartridge has to levitate. But a bit like the radiators, right? There is this kind of, in a way, this excessive move towards an insistence on something that no one else necessarily needs or should know why. But it's a kind of like, okay, right, this is the ground. We're making the ground that is a kind of insistence.
And we knew from the beginning that we wanted gadgets.
Yeah.
Right? Like we wanted elements of magic on the stage and that we wanted those to be kind of like very analog, practical, gadgety magic. And so like levitation is kind of an obvious like theatrical gadgety trick. Magic, although it turned out to be much more difficult than we thought.
Particularly to get it to stay there. You can have something come up and come down, but to sort of like just stop there.
Yeah, the printer cartridge at like, you know, 3/4 of the way through the play raises off the table and levitates there and just stays there for the rest of the
But all the instructions are in the book if you want to do that yourself.
Yeah, now you can know how to...
Similarly, the sort of undulating, writhing bed. Again, we had this almost a day with the stage manager talking about maybe we should have rats in there that are just... or like this guy, the craftsman man, I don't know, was like, my kid's free, I think, most evening. Like, get them in there.
Under the covers.
It's really, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, it's a really simple answer, but one that has this kind of really analog, like Heath Robinson-esque kind of, you know, cranked thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was a real joy, this sort of noise of sort of sparkle of really mechanical magic, you know, analog stuff. Felt very theatrical, but also very attuned to the mood of the whole situation, I think. You know.
Yeah. And now we're showing the bed as a standalone sculpture.
Oh, yeah, man.
And I think it's really, it's like a wonderful thing on its own, too, because it feels like it's like it would be a prop in kind of like a regional haunted house or something like that, right? It's this like very beautiful, very mechanical thing. You can almost see how it works, but it is magic.
Yeah,
it's incredible looking. It looks really strange and good and uncanny and
okay, maybe that's a good place to
actually let me ask, where are you showing the bed?
In New York in a Gladstone Gallery, so you know, rush over there.
Yeah.
It's really easy to make though, it really is, like, it's all in the book.
There's a diagram.
There's a diagram.
Yeah.
The book is for sale.
Yeah.
You can get a signed copy.
Thank you all for your questions. It's great to hear so much like curiosity and enthusiasm. And thank you, Ed, Steve, and Emily. Thank our guests. Come and buy some books. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.